2008, I had the good fortune to meet Mike Mears, then and still an executive board member at Mercy Corps, an international NGO. Mike's guidance, wisdom, and friendship were indispensable as I was trying to navigate the complex new NGO terrain at Mercy Corps as the CIO and CTO. Mike possesses an exceptional blend of skills and knowledge hard won from decades in executive leadership and board member roles in both the private sector and nonprofit world, among them serving as a senior VP and general manager at Intel. I prevailed on Mike for his perspective on nonprofit boards and board members, and he didn't disappoint. Here's my conversation with Mike. Mike Mears, welcome to the Nonprofiteers Podcast.
Thank you, Chip.
Yeah, it's really good to see you. For the second time, if we say that, we had some technical difficulties on our first session, which is not unusual.
Okay.
Yeah. So in the interest of full disclosure, you and I have worked together in the past. We both worked at Mercy Corps. I was the CIO, CTO there. It was my first nonprofit, big nonprofit job. Mm-hmm. And you were on the executive board.
Yes, I was on the board, and my focus was in the social ventures area.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a real pleasure working with you, Mike. And I can say in the course of my lifetime, I've had three great mentors, and you, I count as one of them. So thank you for the time together.
Thanks, Chip. And you know, the feeling's mutual. I know this sounds corny, but having somebody who really has a broad view of IT from a impact and the basic capability standpoint, it was a pleasure for me. I didn't see a lot of those people at Mercy Corps, so I gravitated to you right away.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we both, you know, I was at Lotus, IBM, and Iris for many years, and you were at Intel. So, you know, I think there's some simpatico there, and that was a great environment. That was a tough job because, you know, I don't know if you remember, but I had to be the CTO, which was kind of outer facing, working with beneficiaries and working the technology there, like Bank Endara and some other things we did. Mm-hmm. And then also the CIO responsible for all the internal technology infrastructure. So It was, I think I chewed it okay, but it was more than I thought I could chew at first.
So. Welcome to the technology industry.
Yeah, exactly. I will say it was no worse than trying to pound out the fifth or sixth release of Lotus Notes.
Got it.
So let's start by telling us how you got started at Mercy Corps and a little bit about your private sector background before that.
Okay. Yeah, in the private sector, I was very fortunate. I wound up, at the time, there was no Google search. I went to the library. I looked for companies in the computer side, and I discovered Intel. And this was just at the time when Intel was about ready to introduce the microprocessor. And so I put in my resume in hard written form, and it got to Andy Grove, who at the time was the executive VP. I was lucky enough to have him call me in for an interview. We had a really, probably the best interview that I can ever remember. It was so engaging and interesting. And then they offered me a job on the production line as an engineer, which I turned down because I said, you know, I really want to get some management experience. And then they came back, and Andy came back and said, okay, so we've got a management job here, a technical job on the production line where you'll be managing, you know, a group of people. And how about that? And I said, great. And that's how I started at Intel.
That's incredible.
Thank you. And then I became a little impatient with the standard process of manufacturing and so forth. And we had this was at a time where the microprocessor group was just getting started. A guy named Bill Davidow was the general manager and started it up. And so I said, you know, I'm going to talk to Bill and see if there's any opportunity for me, since I had worked at IBM as a design engineer, and see if there's an opportunity for me to do anything there. We had a really good interview, and then Bill said, you know, normally I wouldn't hire you because, you know, you've been out of the computer industry for a little while. But he said, but, you know, we really need people with some computer experience. And he said, We've got a job possibility here to run the microprocessor development system business from a marketing perspective. And how about that? He said, talk to Jim Lally, who was the guy running it. I did. We hit it off. I took the job. And that's how I really got started with Intel and on the computer side. But then I was lucky enough. Well, then several other things happened. And to make a long story short, you know, I left Intel for a startup. But then I decided I really wanted to come back. And a couple of guys who were running the business, the whole personal computer side of the business, who I knew, said, you know, if you come back, Mike, we've got a great job for you. You can start the networking business at Intel. And I said, oh, that sounds like a very interesting job. Wow. So I said, sure, count me in. So I was really lucky. I got a chance to really put together the business plan for a networking business that was focused really on using PC for management of the whole networking process. And, you know, we grew the business to about $300 million in about 4 years. And, you know, we kind of pioneered the whole idea of smart network services, which were embedded in the personal computer. And I had a wonderful group of people I was working with. You know, we then pioneered, we actually acquired some really terrific network management software that were in nodes on the PC. And we included that in the solutions that we provided. We had an opportunity to really help drive the Ethernet standard to the next levels. And the business just did really well. And I have to say that people I worked with were some of the best people I've ever worked with in my life. And we had a great time and we learned a lot. And during the course of that time, I was really fortunate because I had a great group general manager, a guy named Frank Gill, gave me an opportunity to be the business unit manager. As a result of that, I got a chance to get tutoring from Andy Grove, who was the CEO, and took it upon himself to actually tutor all the managers at Intel because he felt it was so critical to get across some very important ways that Intel was very resolute about managing. So that's a long way of saying I had a tremendous opportunity. I took advantage of it. I had some great tutoring and we were able to do some very interesting things.
Yeah, the things that stand out for me in that story, the incredible stuff is how quickly you moved up through both opportunity, but also seizing the opportunity and seeing that it was a great thing. But another incredible part of the story is the very first part. It's almost like you had a blindfold on and you need to put your finger on the map.
That's true.
Well, that's kind of how I landed at Iris, and there are similarities because at Iris, I don't know if you remember this, but I left Iris and I got a call from Ray Ozzie. You know, Ray Ozzie was my Andy Grove for me. And Ray Ozzie called me and he said, you know, I'd left to be the CTO of a startup called Essence in Beverly, Mass. And he called me one night and he said, how are things going in Essence? And I said, this is like 3 months after the job. And I'd complained to someone at Iris about, you know, it wasn't what I expected it to be. The business was being run on the basis of family dynamics, which is never a good way to make decisions. So there were a lot of issues with the business. And so I think Ray had heard from someone that I was, you know, a malcontent there. So he called me one night and he said, how's things going at Essence? And I said, you know, it's going okay. And he goes, honestly? And I said, no, it's really not going well at all. I really hate it there. And he goes, you want to come back to Iris? And I said, yes. Without even blinking an eye. So
that's a real compliment. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah. So I came back to Iris. So, and fortunate you, you know, well, tell me the things you learned from Andy Grove that you then brought into your role as executive board member at Mercy Corps.
Yeah, there were multiple things. The number one thing was the importance of quantifying success, the creation of quantifiable success metrics, which leads to another thing, which is the importance of continuous improvement. The idea is that you never get it completely right from the get-go, the way you structure things to provide a product, solve a problem, and so forth. But if you have quantifiable metrics, and you're constantly monitoring them, and you're intellectually honest, about what's working and what's not working. You can continuously improve the whole solution and create something that is stellar, because as you monitor definable, quantifiable metrics, you're intellectually honest with yourself, you're continuously improving the process, you're likely to create solutions that are really outstanding. So those were some of the really important things. And the last thing that he brought out, which he really role modeled, was constructive confrontation. In other words, in meetings, we were all encouraged to be honest about what was not working and to have debates and discussions about how to improve things. And we were told, no matter what level, I mean, we had situations where we would criticize Andy and say, we think you're wrong, and this is why, and you're not taking this into account. And he would accept that. In fact, he would encourage it. So all of these things working together create a process of continually improving towards excellence and not resting on your laurels, not being intellectually dishonest about what was working, what was not working. And that's something I carried forward both in my departments that I ran and also in other organizations. You know, I was the CEO of a couple of startups, and we encouraged that same kind of process and philosophy there. And I think it worked well.
Yeah, those are such great points of wisdom. It's amazing, because all those things were operative at Lotus and Iris as well, which accounts for how great the culture was and how much I loved working there. Intellectual honesty, continuous improvement, and you manage what you measure, right? So you have to measure stuff. I think those are some keystones, not the only keystones maybe, but definitely the, you know, in the top 5 to 7 keystones of having a great culture. So let me ask you this. Do you think those virtues are cultivated at nonprofits you've worked for?
I think that some of them are, and I think many of them are not, because of a desire to maintain, quote, a positive culture in a difficult environment. So I think sometimes that can work against those. Sometimes there's a natural proclivity to say, you know, we're working in the world's hardest places, the most difficult things. You know, it's not constructive to confront issues on a regular basis and to dig in and criticize what's going on and to say, hey, you know what, if we're measuring these things, they're really not working. We really should be changing this and this. Sometimes there's more of an emphasis on having a positive environment. And sometimes that works against this whole continuous improvement process.
Do you think that, and I saw this at Mercy Corps, there are a lot of people who wanted to measure stuff, who were interested in metrics. And I remember there was someone who was actually in charge of metrics. I think it's fair to say it's never impossible. It's absolutely desirable, but it's a little bit harder at a nonprofit where you have to measure things like social impact, social progress. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think if it's social progress and so forth, it's really critical to assign metrics to them. And you may have to think a lot deeper, but unless you're honest about what constitutes success and an ability to really measure, are you making progress towards that success, you're deluding yourself. So you can be very popular with a group of people who are marginalized. They can love you. But if their quality of living is not improving, and the quality of living of the people around them is not improving, and you're defining that quality in a very specific way and making continuous improvement, if that isn't happening, you're not really helping them. You may be, they may love you. They may really enjoy working with you. They may speak volumes about how great you are to work with. But in the end, if you're not really improving the quality of life for their constituents and the people around them, you're not accomplishing your goals.
Yeah, absolutely. In a way that they can sustain once you're gone.
Exactly. Yeah. That is really a critical point.
I don't think there was a single thing I participated in there that could not have been measured.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And, but I think that sometimes, not all the time, it's an excuse that's thrown up. You know, we can't do this. The other thing that happens, and I'd like you to talk about this a little bit, and this is probably more common, that, you know, results are whitewashed. So the board and investors and funders and donors don't get nervous,
mm-hmm.
which is the antithesis of intellectual honesty, as you described.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that does more harm than good in the long run. But what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think sometimes the metrics that are chosen are metrics that the organization knows they can strut their stuff and say we're accomplishing that because it helps them to get funding. Unfortunately, the funders are not being intellectually honest about, gee, is this really making a difference? I can just say, oh, we met all our metrics and this wonderful nonprofit organization that we help fund achieved all these wonderful things versus mm-hmm. is it making the impact that it really needs to make? And where are the problems and what can we do to continuously improve the way this organization mm-hmm. operates? Sometimes it's much more about strutting our stuff and showing all the things we've accomplished versus what are the most important things to gain leverage to get to the next level. And yeah. I mean, you see this in politics today and you see it sure. in nonprofit organizations and you see it in a lot of places. It's hard yeah. to acknowledge that there are deficiencies and that there are things that you should be doing much better. It's a hard thing to do, but if it's yeah. embedded in the culture, then it becomes part of the process.
Yeah. The other thing that's endemic at nonprofits is underreporting expenses, underreporting what it takes to get the job done, because Charity Navigator and other organizations rate nonprofits on the ratio of overhead to money that gets to beneficiaries.
Right.
And if that looks ugly, you're penalized for it. I think a lot of people working at nonprofits, particularly senior leaders, don't want to encounter that negative. That's the start of the starvation cycle where, you know, you underreport expenses, you need more money, people think you're being successful, so they don't donate, and right. things just get, it turns into a negative spiral downward.
No, that's a very good observation.
Yeah. So at Mercy Corps specifically, what did you learn about your role as a board member and what board members should do and what things should they not do or maybe be aware of and try to avoid or treat as exceptional, interventions?
Yeah, I think one of the big mistakes that I made was to try to understand the CEO's vision of what the organization, where the organization was really positioned. So we had an offsite that was very interesting. Neil Kennigeyer was the CEO. He was fantastic. He took mm-hmm. the organization from a much smaller organization to much more significant, impactful, yeah. larger organization. But we had an offsite to basically define what is the mission of Mercy Corps and where is Mercy Corps going to really be stellar. And in my mind, one of the most important things that I thought differentiated Mercy Corps from a lot of other nonprofits was more in the development space, where Mercy Corps was using a lot of the entrepreneurial techniques, the new venture techniques that I was familiar with, to gain leverage and do it in a unique way and to get to mm-hmm. scale. It worked only really in developing countries, not in a relief environment, because a relief right. environment was so chaotic, there was no way right. to have the structure in place to do that type of thing. Yeah. So my contention to Neil was, hey, you know what? Where we really shine, and no, I haven't seen any other nonprofits that are doing this as well as Mercy Corps, is in the social venture space. But the social venture space really thrives more in the developing environment than the relief environment, because the relief environment, again, mm-hmm. is pure chaos.
Yeah.
And Neil said, You know, that's true with social ventures, Mike, but my passion is in relief. And what I really see Mercy Corps as is a leader in the area of going to the world's worst places and making a difference. And I said, hey, you know what? I think there are a significant number of other organizations, Save the Children and CARE and Catholic Relief and et cetera, who are all playing in that space. And our ability to differentiate ourselves from all the rest of them, I don't see it as major, but I don't see a whole bunch of people playing in the social venture space. And I think there we're further along in identifying how to make a major difference. And I think we should really be more focused in the developing world versus the pure relief world. But he was the CEO and I was just a board member, and obviously he won. So that was, and I understood that.
You characterize that as a mistake, and I would say it's a perfect example of intellectual honesty, right? And if you can't say that to Neil, who you gonna say it to? So did you characterize it as a mistake from the point of view of you shouldn't have said it, or a mistake? The other point is nonprofits are not different than the private sector in terms of their need to differentiate with customers or donors in the nonprofit world, right? So you need to differentiate yourself. Everyone's competing for funding. What are the things you're really great at? What are you different at? So I'm struggling. I think what you did makes a lot of sense. I'm struggling to figure out how you care, why you're characterizing as a mistake.
Well, I think it was an eye-opener for me, and it caused me to ultimately say, I probably should not be part of this if I can't really achieve what I want to. Now, the Social Ventures Group, to Mercy Corps' credit, has grown enormously since I left, and it's achieved a lot of excellent results, and it's gotten more money to invest. So I can't say it's been a success. From my perspective, I was not as passionate about the release side of the business and or of the charitable organization. And so it ultimately led me to say, I think it was 7 years at Mercy Corps, and I thought, it's probably time for me to look elsewhere and to see what I can do.
Do you feel like you overstepped your role as an executive board member in that scenario? Because I mean, I'll come to your rescue right away and say, I don't think you did, but do you think you did?
No, I think it was a good conversation and it forced a discussion. And I think the majority of the board agreed with Neil. And I think they felt like the primary place Mercy Corps could make the biggest difference was in relief because there was such a giant need there. Where my feeling was, again, there were a lot of people providing that capability, and there weren't a lot of people providing the capability to take social ventures and to get it to scale and to make a huge difference in the more developed world. So anyway, I thought it was a good discussion, and I'm not sorry that we had the discussion. And I thought my time with Mercy Corps, I really enjoyed it. I think I helped the social ventures team to get to a level that was continuously improving. I challenged a lot of the assumptions. I worked with a lot of the people to continuously improve what they were doing. And I felt very good about that.
The most interesting work I did there was with the social ventures team. Bank Indara in Indonesia and some other efforts were the most interesting things. And like you said, the Haiti earthquake happened when I was there. And talk about chaos. You're drowning. You can just barely keep your head above water if you're a relief worker. So what are some mistakes you think board members make typically, right? Maybe you didn't make them, but what are some mistakes that board members make, you think?
I think some of the mistakes that I observed, and I don't want to name any names or anything, but people who aspire to satisfy the senior leadership within the organization rather than challenge them. I think they a lot of board members view their role as to amplify the wishes and instantiate. the programs that the senior management wants to put into place versus critique them, potentially change the direction. I don't think there were a lot of board members that I worked with who were very anxious to do that. I think they viewed their role as being an amplifier of the CEO's strategies and wishes versus a catalyst for continuous improvement. Yeah. I think there's a lot of that on boards.
Does that strike you as is just human nature? Because if you asked most board members what their role is, they would say to assist the CEO with strategy, which is what you described as the right approach, right? To be a catalyst for being skeptical about strategy and helping the CEO, not forge strategy, not amplify unconditionally the existing strategy and then help with execution. That's not the role of the board member.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of board members that feel that way. And I think they feel job one is to help raise money, you know, and raising money by amplifying the CEO's positions and, you know, being an asset for the CEO and raising money, I think is what a lot of board members, and I think they do it very well. And I'm not suggesting it's an inconsequential thing to do. It's obviously very important because that's where revenue comes from for a nonprofit. Yeah. It does create a dearth of challenges which result in continuous improvement. Sometimes it just reinforces doing things the same way in order to raise money.
One of the classic temptations and problems of a board member is spilling over from a strategy role into an execution operational role, right? Crossing the operational boundary. Two-part question for you. Did you see any of that, number one? And number two, how did you avoid, you know, that temptation if you were ever attempted? How did you manage that tension?
Yeah, I tried to have discussions with the people I work with. Let's take the social venture team and discuss and have discussions that were intellectually honest. These are things I think are going well. These are areas where I question, I think major improvement is needed, and this is why. I tried to develop a relationship where we could, where number one, I could challenge them, and number two, they could challenge me. They could come back and say, hey, you know what, Mike, I think what you're saying is incorrect because you're not on the ground, and this is what I'm observing, and this is where I think you're wrong. I tried to encourage dialogue that was intellectually honest and non-confrontational, but yet allowed different points of view to emerge and allowed both of us to continuously improve the programs. I thought that was really, really important. And I tried to listen to what other people were telling me. They, you know, they would tell me things like, you know, this might have worked in the technology venture at eTrieve that you were the CEO, but it doesn't work here for these reasons, because the environment is not as structured and it's a disaster here. You know, so you can't take what you've done and just apply it there because it doesn't work. And they were right. Yeah. And by the same token, I think I infused in them the need to be more involved in continuously improving the process and not sitting back and saying, we've been doing this for 5 years, so we just want to keep doing it. And we've been successful, to say, you know, come on. We need to continuously improve what we're doing to increase our funding, to increase our impact. So I think that dialogue that was with mutual trust was a very important thing to do.
You did a couple of things well working with me. One of the things you did is always ask me questions. And questions are a great way to avoid the ad hominem attacks that can often come with criticism. So even if you feel strongly about a point, it's better to ask the person question. That's a coaching technique. It's just a great way of communicating if you're a human being. So I always felt like you were really good at that. You asked a lot of questions, and, you know, confrontation's okay, but not confrontation that turns into personal attacks. And that's what we both had at Iris and Lotus and Intel, environments where you could put forward a point of view, and the person knew it wasn't a personal attack. You were just trying to make headway with the business.
When you think you're right and you're dead sure you're right, you can very often get into destructive confrontation where it gets personal. You're arguing a case. The other person is an idiot. They're not, they don't get it. It's much better to try to internalize the feedback that you're getting, to accept the fact that some of it is probably valid, and to push back on the parts that aren't. And that's the whole process, I think, of constructive confrontation, where each person who's having the confrontation is bringing something to build a better solution. And acknowledging that that's the case is a really important part of the process, I think.
Listening is also a critical attribute that you mentioned. Do you think that's a lost art in the modern world?
It is absolutely a lost art. Talking over, thinking, instead of actively listening, thinking about your rebuttal while the other person is talking seems to be the standard way of operating these days. Scoring points exceeds internalizing what I'm hearing and thinking, wow, there are other ways to approach this, and they add a lot of value. I think it's an unfortunate thing. I think it exists in spades today.
Yeah, in the political sphere particularly, it seems like even if you understand active listening, people don't want to bring it to bear. They don't want to listen. They don't care about listening.
Right. And they don't want to acknowledge a mistake or a weakness. Acknowledging a mistake is implies I'm weak. And I think in the nonprofit world, there's a lot of that too. You know, oh, I want to be able to strut my stuff to people who are going to put money into the nonprofit. I don't want to show any weakness because they don't want to hear any weakness. But good funders do want to hear about weakness, and they do want to hear about mistakes, and they want to hear what you've learned from it and how you've continuously improved in providing solutions that are adding more value.
What's your point of view on how to educate funders so you don't enter the starvation cycle, you don't get into a situation where their expectations are misset and where they don't believe you're doing enough?
I think taking the funders, and by the way, this also involves board members, to the environments that you're trying to support and help, and exposing them to the issues that you're dealing with and educating them in the different dimensions of what the problems are and what the potential solutions are. The more educated they can be, the more they understand what you're dealing with. It's very, very important. And the fact that being intellectually honest with the funders about the mistakes that you've made along the way and what you've learned from them, I think is also very important. I think people are very reluctant to tell a funder, I made these mistakes, because, oh my God, you've made mistakes. Why would we put more money into your organization? Well, smart funders know that everybody makes mistakes. And the thing they want to avoid is funding organizations that are rigid and not evolving. And so I think that's very, very important.
Yeah, this has come up in other podcast interviews, but you know, we don't like to acknowledge that everything is an experiment. Mm-hmm. And they're very well, you know, they might be very smart, well-constructed experiments where the probability of success is high, but it's still an experiment. And experiments, you know, we should not encourage stupid failures, if there is such a thing, but smart failures, right?
And, you know, there's another point, too, that the breakthroughs very often come from very risky types of decisions about programs, and the iterations on those programs can often create a breakthrough. But with some of the successes have come some significant failures along the way. But if you don't take some of those risks, you're not going to get a breakthrough. So it's really a function of what part of your portfolio are high risk, high return, and what part of it is lower risk, lower returns. And just like any kind of people who are investing, and in this case, it's donors, there should be a portfolio of that.
Yeah. So what are the things you've really loved talked about being an executive board member with a nonprofit?
The people in the organization were so dedicated, so motivated, and very often very entrepreneurial in their thinking. I loved that. I thought that was fantastic. I saw a reasonable amount of constructive confrontation, which I thought was very healthy. People disagreeing and explaining in a very clear way what their disagreements were, but in a non-hostile way. I saw a lot of that. The other thing is just watching the impact on the people that the organization is focused on helping. In Gaza, it was as big a disaster, almost as big a disaster as it is today. It was terrible. What we observed were a whole bunch of well-educated, very smart, younger people who had actually pretty good IT skills, who were isolated. A guy named Andy Dwanch, who was the country director for Palestine, observed that.
Yeah.
And said, you know what? I think there's an opportunity to connect these people. They weren't going to get on a plane and go to San Francisco and have a successful career. That was impossible at the time. But because of the internet, they had every opportunity of working remotely and joining some of the most advanced technology companies in the world and making a significant difference. And Andy saw that. He saw that opportunity. And he was smart enough and lucky enough to have an executive from Google who was interested in understanding, are there any opportunities that Google could have in working with these people? And she went down, he took her down to Gaza. She observed how capable some of these young technology people were. The fact that they had at the time, they had some infrastructure that allowed them to connect directly with these ventures in the Bay Area. And lo and behold, they formed the Gaza Sky Geeks. And until the catastrophe in Gaza recently, it was incredibly successful. And a large number of people had very meaningful, self-sustaining jobs that were very rewarding in Gaza. And number two, they helped the large organizations they worked for by providing some very important skills. So it was really a win-win. And that's an example, really, of a Mercy Corps manager seeing an opportunity that nobody else saw and doing all the things he needed to do to get the right people in place in the Bay Area, in Gaza, in Israel, in all kinds of places to really make it happen.
Yeah. What you're describing feels a little bit like the entrepreneurial mindset, being able to see opportunities to make connections that way. And, you know, Andy certainly was that. In fact, I was there working with Andy on that very thing you described. Okay. I was there for a few days. I was in Jerusalem and then the West Bank and talked to some Palestinian tech folks. And it was truly amazing.
It was. And understanding the opportunity and not being afraid of some of the failures along the way, you know, and making the linkages and doing the, just like any entrepreneur, you know, you're going to have some things that are going to work and you have some things that don't, but overall the vector is moving in the right direction.
Yeah. So if you were going to give three pieces of advice to, I'm going to say a board member, some of this is already built into what you've already said, but you know, I'd like you to summarize it or just come up with some new things too, if you feel like it. What are three pieces of advice you would give to a board member working for a nonprofit?
Okay. Number one, understand success metrics. What are the success metrics? How do they drive the organization? And be very sure that you understand how to measure the success metrics as well. Number two, understand the hinge factors in achieving those success metrics. Be intellectually honest about what are the barriers that exist today in achieving those success metrics, and what are the catalysts that can really accelerate the achievement of the success metrics. And, you know, number three, understand the roles and responsibilities of different people within the organization to affect the success metrics. Who are the people you need to work with to help, to influence, to listen to, that can really make a difference within the organization. And very often it's not the leaders of those particular, it's people embedded in the organization that have tremendous insights. So those are three things, I think. And I guess I have to add a fourth, understand the CEO and his or her motivations, and can they be challenged or are they resolute? And that's a very important factor as well. Or are you going to be able ever be able to achieve the kind of change that needs to happen?
Yeah. And related to that, I would add a fifth that you already said, which is be a healthy, constructive skeptic.
Yes.
Challenge that, don't just amplify senior leadership strategies, but challenge the strategies.
Absolutely. Constructive confrontation. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes. That's a very good point. Yeah.
Good. So one more question for you, Mike, and I'll cast this in the light of not the larger arc of history, which I do think is bending toward justice. But for, let's say, last few years, do you think the world is getting better or the world is getting worse?
Let me think about that. I think the world is getting more polarized. And I think the problem with that is that people focus, instead of focusing on systemic solutions to problems, I think emotion has become a much bigger factor in people, how people think. So if emotionally I feel I'm being marginalized by the people in power, and there's a messiah here who is coming down to take away all the things that those people have been doing wrong, I'm going to embrace the messiah, because the messiah embraces my emotional status. He or she understands me. They understand the emotional trauma I'm going through, and that's the only person I want to deal with. But people who think systemically, who are in potential positions of power, very often are not given the credit for the ability to solve problems. Systemic thinking, I think, unfortunately, has taken a back seat to emotional. Am I a progressive? Am I a conservative? Do I have the chops that show that I'm that or this? Versus what are the problems? What are the potential solutions? And who are the best people who have the training and the intellect to systemically fix these problems? I think that's the fundamental problem that we're dealing with today. And I see it all over the world. I see it in the United States. I see it in France. I see it in Israel. I see it in England. I see it everywhere, really. Everywhere.
Yeah. And the tribalism you're describing blunts exactly that capacity for being rational, for being systemic, for being outer directed instead of thinking about what's best for your group or your, megomaniacal messiah for the week or day or year or whatever.
Yeah, and demonizing and being angry with the people who don't think like you do is another attribute that's destroying progress, really. So I think, going back to more admiration and instantiation of successful systemic thinkers is a key to really solving the really serious problems around the world that we're dealing with. But until that happens, if we continue to put into power people who stroke the emotional things that matter to a lot of people, we're going to continue to degrade, I think.
Yeah. Well, unfortunately, I agree with you. The saving grace is that, history is cyclical, if nothing else. So at some point we'll emerge from, this
chaos,
this chaotic, ridiculous down cycle of non-cooperation. And, there's so many things that have happened. People don't believe in science anymore. People don't believe in experts anymore. Right. People don't, it's crazy what what passes for knowledge and information now.
Yes.
But, yeah. Preaching to the converted, I'm sure.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Mike, it's been such a pleasure to speak. It's always a pleasure to speak with you. And I'm so glad we were able to talk about nonprofit leadership and board members. And thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Chip. And thank you for being a catalyst to having these discussions and exposing a large number of other people to these kinds of discussions. I think it's really critical for continuous improvement.
Yeah, I do too. Well, I hope it seems to be happening. I hope it continues to happen.
Good.
Thanks again, Mike. Take care of yourself.
Okay, you too, Chip. Great talking to you as usual.
You too. Bye-bye.